JC, you hear me?
Yo, check us out. Chuck D, Public Enemy.
Yo, what's up? This is DJ Yellow from the world's most dangerous group.
What's up? This is DOC, the Diggy Diggy motherfucking God.
Yo, 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 what's up? This is your boy, Z-Man.
What up, dog? This is E-Shot.
This is Jerry Heller, motherfucker.
It's your boy, DJ Paul KOL from 36 Block.
Young Busy Bone.
Vice Warp.
It's your man, Mastermind of Hellraiser.
Yo, this is DJ Ready Red.
What up, what up, what up? This is the real Rick Ross, and you're listening to me on the Murder Master Music Show.
Put out about 875 tapes. No, just joking, but he put out a ton of music at a time, you know, before the internet. You know, he was slanging them out the trunk and really helping the underground Memphis scene grow. You know, it was all about tapes back then, and this is one of the guys that was doing it. Let me bring on King JC. JC, how you doing, brother?
Hey, Prez, what's good, brother?
Man, welcome back. Last time we had you on with the group West 10, you and DJ Trick. Again, congratulations on that. You guys are doing phenomenal. And you guys actually have an album out right now, right? Full album?
Yes, sir. Finally got the full album out. And, yeah, getting great reception from it, folks digging it. And I'm just glad to be making music again, brother. It's lovely.
Oh, yeah, definitely, man. We need you, and I'm glad you're back. Tonight, we're going to go down memory lane a little bit. We're going to go to the days away back when you first started. What gave you the rap bug initially, man? What were some of the earliest releases that you got a hold of?
Man, going back to my days in Boston, I was real, real young. We're talking elementary school. Second, third grade, being so close to New York, the B-boy was big. It was just starting out. The whole breakdancing was a big cultural thing there. So I'd hear the music that the guys on the street would dance to. And it came to be hip-hop, but in the earlier form, it was more of an electro-funk kind of sound. But of course, man, just early rap music, when I started getting into buying rap tapes or even 45s back then, we had records even before tapes, but I'd say it was cats like Ice-T. When the first Beastie album came out, the License to Ill album, that was a big one for me. That influenced me a lot. And but everything, man. I mean, Run DMC, Fat Boys, all the old hip hop. I was digging all of it. Anything that would come out, I was up on it.
Yeah, you were like me, you when you heard it, you were probably like, wow, what the hell is this? I really like it, and just fell in love with it from there.
Yeah. Absolutely, man. Definitely.
Now this, you said you were in Boston. Different scene from Memphis, obviously. How long were you in Boston growing up?
I was in Boston 5 to 6 years. From the time before I even started grade school, we were in Boston because I was born in Phoenix and then moved with my family to Boston. And then ended up living outside of the city of Boston. But initially we were there in Boston, and I mean, that's where I was introduced to the music. But 5, 6 years there, then we ended up going out to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and that was a whole different scene out there. Really, when I got to Albuquerque, there was no real hip-hop scene whatsoever out there. I had to introduce hip-hop and even groups that were out nationally. I had to introduce them to folks because they just weren't up on it.
So you essentially kind of brought the hip-hop scene out there to Albuquerque then?
Man, I would like to think that I did. I don't know if there were small pockets of other cats at that time doing stuff, but I started real early with writing and recording. And so, man, recording from the time of 4th grade going into 5th grade, and then actually releasing something in Albuquerque in 92, which I don't believe there was anybody in the entire state of New Mexico releasing rap tapes at that point.
No, I mean, I didn't hear nothing about Albuquerque till years later, till when I discovered you, you know, in Everlasting Drama. But that's okay. So you went from Boston to Albuquerque. At what point did you move to Memphis?
93 would have been Memphis, and that I came into Memphis already being an established artist to a point. I mean, nobody in Memphis knew who I was, but I did have tapes recorded, somewhat pressed. As best as we knew how to press them, the J cards were kind of homemade and, you know, little adhesive labels. And so we had some tapes by the time I got to Memphis. And, man, I just remember getting out there trying to network with folks and pass my tapes out. And folks were real receptive when they saw that I was doing music. And I plugged into the scene pretty quick after getting to Memphis.
So you came to Memphis with music in hand already, which that was a plus, you know, because you had guys like at that time, of course, you know, Paul and them were just starting out. Gangsta Pat had already had a major deal at that time. So you were coming into a city that was coming into its own at the same time, pretty much.
Yeah, yeah. I did know who Pat was. Before coming to Memphis, I just didn't know he was from Memphis until I had I signed with a label called OB Records at the time, and there were a few of us on that label. He had some good producers working with him on that label as well. But we had a show, and it was me, Lady J, Big Mark, some of the – I think SMK was there with us possibly. And I just remember they were saying that we were going to rock a show with Gangsta Pat. And the only Gangsta Pat I knew thought he was from L.A. because I saw his tape cover, and he had the curl, and he had the whole gangsta, the West Coast gangsta look. And so I just assumed he was from L.A., but then I just thought maybe there was another Gangsta Pat. But when we picked him up, our limo pulled up into where he lived at the time in Whitehaven. We called it Black Haven back then. And, man, we pulled up, this man come out, and I knew right away it was him. And so that's when I first found out Pat was actually from Memphis.
Yeah. I didn't know where he was from until years later myself. I kind of thought he was like heavily influenced by DJ Quick because, you know, he had the gangster groove, Quick Hit, Quick's groove.
Oh, yeah.
But he came out at the same time, though. You know,
right
around, 91. you know, so, oh, that's dope. So you knew right away that was Gangsta Pat.
Yeah.
Did you get a chance to, you know, see him work or do any production?
Yeah, I did, actually, but it was years later. I had a group called Second Family, and I was over in Southern Hills. Pat, we both lived in the same area of Memphis, which was Whitehaven. And I was over in Southern Hills. He was in Red Oaks over by the airport. So one of my artists from Second Family was real close with Pat, and he was kind of double dipping. He was Pat's artist and my artist at the same time. He was the extended part of my group, Second Family, but he was also working with Gangsta Pat under a group called Die Hard Organization, and his
okay.
name was Lil Rock.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
so
and so
mutual.
So
artist.
I'd go over there to. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, brother.
No, I just said a mutual artist.
Yeah, yeah. I thought he was rolling with me and with Playalistic, but he was still over there working with Pat. So I would go pick him up, and he'd be like, "Yeah, we're in here working." And so I remember a couple of times going in there, hanging out, seeing Pat do his thing, you know, with Little Rock, and Pat was making some incredible tracks. He was really good on that production.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Definitely. When did you pick up, you said you was, you know, you came to Memphis with music in hand. Were you already producing out in Albuquerque?
A little bit, not much. I was blessed on my first tape to meet a guy who was actually in a rock band, and he was a producer for a rock group, and he worked at the at Grandma's Music and Sound out there, which was where you would buy audio gear. And I would go in there all the time and just pick up little pieces and try to figure out how to build this studio so I could do all my own recording. And he showed me how to work a four track, and he introduced me to the four track, but then he'd break out a drum machine. He'd go grab a keyboard. And this is all gear that was there on the floor at Grandma's Music. And, man, we ended up recording what became my first tape there in the back room of that store with the gear
oh, wow.
that he was selling. Yeah, so it ended up, my first tape ended up having a cool little sound. I mean, you listen to it now and it's like, ooh, that was way back in the day, four track, analog. You could tell it's old, but it sounded much better than some of the stuff that I went on to do myself when I plugged up in my bedroom. And man, I recorded, with a mic into a mixer, and I was recording break beats. I would get break beat records on vinyl, and I would literally play the vinyl and have the mic plugged in and then run everything to my two track, my double cassette recorder. And I would just record like it was a live show. And that's how I did my first two albums.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's amazing right there. That's kind of like when we were interviewing Isham. I remember him telling us he went in, he didn't have enough studio time or enough money to, you know, so they had to, I guess, record the whole album, Booming Words from Hell, in one block, you know, over
wow.
the course of a day or so. And then I heard later on K. Lou, they did the Ice Cream Man over the course of a weekend. You know, but
man.
That's nothing new to you. You're already doing that. You're starting off doing that. Did the production come easy for you over the course of time, as easy as the rapping did, or which was easier for you?
Well, the rap was came pretty natural for me. It was something I just loved doing, and I started writing at such a young age, man, that I was able to learned to write and freestyle. I got into battle rapping early on. So it just kind of came more naturally. The production was a little more difficult, but I was kind of forced into production. And it's not something that I aspired to do. It wasn't a goal of mine. I would have rather had somebody producing tracks and me be the MC. But, man, it got to the point where folks they kind of were busting me over the head on beats, you know, back then, which really looking at it now, it wasn't that expensive. But, man, when you're young, I was a teenager. I was a young teenager. I didn't have that kind of money. So even though a lot of them were working with me, I still couldn't afford it. So I was forced to try to get a little equipment together, and I just remember hitting a pawn shop in Fraser in the North Memphis area. And, man, dude at that pawn shop really hooked me up and took care of me. I got my first 660, Dr. Rhythm 660 from that pawn shop, and then I got my Insonic VFX, which ended up being that just staple for me in production. That was my board, my sound, even to the point where when that board went out, I had to get another one just like it. And that's what I did. I stuck with that VFX for years. So when you hear those old King JC tapes, you hear those synth sounds, those are all coming off the Insonic VFX.
Oh, yeah. That's, you know what I'm saying? And the music that people don't realize, we're getting ready to play some of it tonight, is super, super rare, super collectible. And you got some plans for it. We're going to talk about that real soon. But let's give them one of these dope tracks. I got three of them loaded up tonight. I want to let you pick, JC. I got Guess Who's Back, I got Step to Drama, and I got The Boogeyman Part 2. Which one do you want to roll with first, brother?
Ooh, let's go with that Boogeyman 2. I love that joint.
Tell them about this one.
Man, so Boogeyman 2 was originally, I had the original Boogeyman on my number 9 tape, and just got such a good feedback off that one that I wanted to do another one for the next tape. And I ended up getting that sample off of the first Elm Street movie, which I had the idea for years, when Nancy walking down the street and that little piano is going, I think it's the next day after Tina got killed. And, man, I heard that piano even as a kid, and I knew I wanted to someday do something with that. So I used that piano, looped it, added a couple more sounds, and then did a very unique drum pattern on it, which was either the 660 or the DR5. It was one of those drum machines. The second I hear it again, I'll remember which one it is.
All right, here we go. This is The Boogeyman Part 2, King JC, right here on the Murder Master Music Show. We'll be right back.
Misfit down, D-Dog and Youngster is so damn legit. Monster so I don't know the things that you know and making you a little hoe. A real street poet from the desert land with the skill to make these tracks with my bare hands. You jealous of my beats, you can't comprehend how I make them so damn hard. I'm the boogeyman. When it comes to get you, when I make you bounce, I be. When I get it, crunk, I am. Make a beat up on this.
What's up right there, King JC, the Boogeyman Part 2. Man, that definitely got that horrorcore vibe to it. Were you influenced a little bit by Gangsta Nip, maybe the Ghetto Boys, Chucky, and things like that?
Definitely Ghetto Boys, yeah, for sure. I didn't hear Gangsta Nip till a little later, but Ghetto Boys, yes, early on, I was up on some Ghetto Boys, for sure.
Oh, yeah, Assassins, and yeah, different things.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, and the beat going on there, too. I always found that horror movies had great samples for beats, you know, Phantasm. What was some other good ones? Return of the Living Dead. I don't know if you've ever sampled anything off that.
I didn't from that one, no, but I wore out Phantasm, though.
Yeah. You know, now when you touched down in Memphis, you know, what was it like adjusting to life there? Was it pretty rough for you at that time in the early 90s?
I was just young, and so I was just a knucklehead, and I got into unnecessary trouble, and that it just, if I could redo it over, things would have been so different, you know. And I think about that a lot, man. If I could have done things different, I would, but just being young, I think I made some bad choices, and I should have been more focused on my music and business, more focused than I was. But touching down in Memphis, I definitely thought the Memphis sound of what it was back then was different. It was unique. But I don't think I was immediately influenced by it. I think over the years, it definitely has rubbed off on me. But early on, I think I had a pretty different sound than what a lot of the early Memphis rappers had. And even the early Memphis rappers had a different sound than what it evolved into. And I've actually had conversations with Al and Zerk about that. So, and they've explained it pretty good to me. I think they make a great argument of why that was. But I think if you listen to the rappers that went national early on, they did kind of have more of a West Coast sound at first. And then that evolved to being more of what became Memphis rap. But I think it just was an industry thing. They were trying to really fit in into the industry of what will get played, what's marketable. And Memphis didn't have that sound yet nationally. So it was almost like the national stage wasn't ready for that sound yet. But when they realized that, man, that we're not really getting that kind of love anyway. We're just going to do what we do. I think that's when it started to take off for them, and they really came out of that shell and really were able to develop that, what became that Memphis sound.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you were putting out tapes, like I said, at the same time that Al Capone, Skinny Pimp, MC Mac, Paul and Juicy and Lord Infamous. What was it like, you know what I'm saying, not really being competition with those guys, but let's say, peers with them at that time? Like, did you have any memories or recollections of maybe running into 3-6 or any of those guys?
Oh, absolutely. With 3-6, definitely. When I got to Memphis, I didn't know who they were. And I spent a good deal of time in Memphis and then went back to Albuquerque, still not knowing who 3-6 was. I brought some music back to Albuquerque with me, and I remember bringing Al Capone, Endo G, and Lil Blunt just dropped their Antidote. And so I brought that out there. And then I was out in Albuquerque for about 6 months. Then I came back. And when I came back to Memphis, that's when I heard 3-6. And, man, it was – they were taking over the town in late 94, man. They were, I mean, saturating the streets of Memphis with underground tapes. They were dropping, like, new volumes constantly. And, man, it was amazing. I can't remember the first one I actually heard. Somebody gave it to me, and man, it had to be one of those Paul and Juicy tapes or Paul and Infamous tapes, one of those volumes, and it blew me away, man. I said, wow, this is a different sound. 3-6 really brought something to Memphis that was very Memphis in its own. Like, if you're from Memphis and you know how Memphis rolls from the slang and the way we operate in the streets, 3-6 brought that and put it on tape, and it's amazing how they captured that. But that when that Mystic Styles hit, I remember they had that single, The Summer, was on the radio. It was like one of the first Memphis rap hits to really take over the radio. I mean, there was Endo G and Blunt and 8-Ball and MJG. They had some songs on the radio before that, but The Summer, man, really took to the local charts on the local radio stations and really blew up. But, I remember running into those guys all the time in the streets. I think the first time I actually met them was Skinny Pimp had a tape shop in Fraser, and ended up Oscar Barnes, the label I was signed to, he ended up taking over that shop and turned it into like a cell phone shop or a pager shop or something. But I remember going into that shop and to holler at Skinny, and all 3-6 was in there. But they were really young guys at that time. I mean, we had to be all about the same age, but I just remember seeing a bunch of young dudes in there about my age. And, man, just talking to them and then finding out, oh, wow, that's – I think it was Skinny who told me, well, yeah, that's – I know Juicy was there. I imagine Paul was there, and maybe Lord Infamous, and they were all hanging out with Skinny in there. So that's the first time I actually met him. And then I ended up moving to Southern Hills in 96, maybe around 96, and DJ Paul lived right behind Southern Hills. And so his I think it was his cousin, lived in Southern Hills with us, Lil Buck. And he would come over there with Buck all the time and ride through. He had an orange Suburban at the time. And I'll just never forget that. Paul coming, hanging out with us, and we used to love to chop it up with him. And that even led to me getting some production from him. So at the time, Paul, even though 3-6 was national, Paul still was messing with some of us local guys and on production, and he wasn't charging the extreme price that you could imagine he might be able to charge, and so, but it was reasonable. He was messing with us, I think, because we were from Southern Hills, we were from his hood. And man, I remember getting beats from Paul for $150 each.
Wow.
And yeah, and I mean, that was actually cheaper than Blackout was charging at that time, because Blackout was charging us $250 a track, and so I couldn't mess with him as much.
Wow.
But,
you know those prices ain't the same now, that's for sure.
Man, those prices hadn't been the same since 96. 96, 97, yeah. I think after
literally
that,
right after that, yeah.
Yeah, that world domination hit, I think that kind of changed everything, you know. And, man, they hit a whole other level of success. And, yeah, things changed. Rightly so.
What was, Jay, what was some of the beats you rapped over on Paul's beats?
So Paul had hooked me up with a couple different, I got a couple different beats from Paul. And, when we were putting together my number six album, we ran into some problems because, Oscar Barnes, I was recording with him and I was trying to get Paul to come over there and dump the track. But I remember he just handed me the track on a cassette tape. And, so it really didn't play out the way I wanted it to. And I ended up with just a bad mix, a bootleg copy of number six straight out the studio where Oscar Barnes just kind of handed me a tape and he was supposed to put it out. But, man, he didn't put it out. And so I got frustrated. So I messed around and put out the next episode on my own, which was number seven. So he was supposed to put out what would have been my number six album, and
wow.
Dragging His Feet, Taking Forever, he didn't do that, so I put out number seven. And so the production that had Paul's tracks on it just sat in Oscar Barnes' studio for a long time. And when we put out I finally got a copy of the tape, we put it out, it wasn't what I was hoping for. It was bad mixes, bad copies. So I had ended up getting what would have been the real tape, the master tape. But by that time, I was already moved on into – I hooked up with DJ Trick. By that time, we were already recording on a bigger level. So I never went back and ended up releasing those songs rightly. Until now, I'm getting ready to do that. And I don't know if we're going to get into all that, what we're getting ready to do. But
yeah, yeah. You're going to have that Paul beat on the wow, you're going to actually go back and kind of get redemption with that number six, so to speak.
Yeah, yes, absolutely, because it'll be the way it was supposed to come out with the remix on the actual masters, from the masters. So that's been something that I've wanted to do for years. But just hadn't really been able to get that done. And so it'll be cool to finally do that along with other things. There's albums that I still have not released yet. My number 17 being the biggest one, where people still, this many years later, still hit me up asking about that album. And it was definitely the best work I had ever done. That number 17 album was crazy. And I always hated that it never saw the light of day, that I couldn't put that out until now.
Number 16
so
was Anna Off My Chest, right?
Yeah, that was the one that ran through Selecto, and we had great distribution on that. It did good numbers, and it actually reached out there. And then number 17 was called My Curse, and that was a follow-up to Anna Off My Chest. And I had been through some bad experiences at that time, so the whole album is like a lament of all those, the what I was going through at that time, which included some really hard personal stuff and
yeah,
family stuff as well. So all that's on that album. So I just unleashed the beast of on the mic, but it was, I had to get that stuff off my chest just to maintain my sanity, but it made for a great album.
Yeah, they always say the best music comes from pain.
Yes.
But this album, 17, why didn't you ever release it?
Well, partly what I was going through, I did have my studio and I had access to record music, but man, I don't know how much of my story that I've shared with you in the past, but at that time, after Anna Off My Chest came out, I was on a promo tour when I got some bad news about who is my ex-wife. that she was facing Fed time. She had got caught up in some mess, some bad stuff. And I was on the road, wasn't knowing about it, but then I ended up getting that call and saying, man, she was getting ready to be locked up, and she was facing some years. And so I had to come back to Memphis, come off the road completely. And that's kind of why Anna Off My Chest ended up stalling out. It was doing real good, and it started to climb, and then boom, it stalled out. And that was because I had to come off the road, and I couldn't promote, and I couldn't do shows, and I couldn't do none of that anymore, because I came back to Memphis to be with my kids while all this was going on, while she was in court. And she ended up doing close to 10 years Fed time. So I was raising my babies, man. I had to pull away from the music for a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Completely understandable. I mean, you know, sometimes life intervenes.
Yeah, yes, sir.
You know, but, yeah, that's a deep story right there. So now you're getting ready to re-release all this stuff that's never seen the light of day. Tell me how you're going to go about doing this. Is it going to be CD, physical, digital?
Say that again, brother.
I was just going to say, is it going to be physical, digital, CDs? How are you going to do this?
Well, so that's twofold. We have actually, I don't know if you're familiar with Trill Hill Tapes, which he's a brother that has, he presses and he does reissues of old, rare underground tapes. And what I like about Trill is he preserves the original sound, the way it's meant to be sound. And he also does short runs. So he may press like 250 copies, and once they're gone, they're gone. So it's a chance for the true collectors to get a hold of those tapes and have them the way they were meant to be. So I've done some reissues with him. They haven't dropped yet, but we've done that. And I think there's more in the works. So we're going to be working together for a while, I'm sure, to bring physical copies of a lot of those old underground tapes. But the other deal that I've been working on is bringing the entire Playalistic catalog out to see the light of day, which is something that never really been done. There's albums within my label's catalog that has never seen the light of day, many of them. My number 17 being one, another collection of songs that I did that really never made any of my albums. And the plan was to put those out as bonuses on CD re-releases. That never happened. And so I've got a collection of those songs that really never seen the light of day. And DJ Trick and I also produced an entire album on Everlasting Drama, that's going to be on there too. Unreleased Everlasting Drama after the old stuff we did. So that's going to be dope.
Time's
and then
up.
There's also some, well after Time's Up. This was years after Time's Up. We did an album with DJ Trick, myself doing the production. And
wow.
And we had Misfit on there. Me, DJ Trick actually is rapping on there with us. And man, it's incredible. And then I got some Second Family unreleased stuff that's never been heard. That's going to be part of this collection. And for years, there's been different people who have hit me up wanting to buy the entire catalog. But man, they just weren't. They were thinking I was not going to do anything with it. I'm just sitting on it. So they'd be like, man, $3,000, $4,000. And I'm sitting there thinking, for the entire catalog, that just doesn't even make any kind of good business sense, you know?
Yeah.
And, so I wasn't willing to do that. And so I never got around to doing that. And I'm grateful now because there's an opportunity that came up to do something that's really never been done before on this level, in this space. And this is involving the crypto world, blockchain and NFTs, which, man, I'm going to be 100% honest, just starting right here with that. I don't know really much about that, and I didn't even know what an NFT was a month ago. Well, about maybe 2 months ago. I didn't know what an NFT was. And so this is all new for me, and I've had to do some quick research and a lot of reading on it. But there's a company that approached me who have done some serious research, and I know that they're really interested in the Memphis underground scene and what's been done in Memphis. But they also were interested in me personally because of my catalog, the fact that I had so much music. They want to present a collection. So it's going to be done as NFTs, but with all these extra bonuses packed into the NFTs. How they do that, I don't know. But I've read the contract and proposal, and, man, it's amazing. It's if we pull this off and this gets executed the way it looks on paper, it's going to be historic. Because it's going to be something that's never been done on this level.
That sounds very, very innovative. And I really, really wish you nothing but the best with that, because it's a great way to introduce the classics to the world all over again, plus those unreleased gems you're talking about. I'm going to go into another song, then the homie Sin from France. I know he's got a few questions for you. But, man, I don't know if it was you. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. Might have read this in an interview. It might be somebody else entirely. Was it you that survived a gunshot wound to the head?
Oh, man. Yeah. Where did you hear that? Well, I might have talked to you about that.
You might have told me.
We've
known each other a good, 20 years. I don't even know where it's coming from. But I just...
Yeah, no.
I know Gangster Pat survived a gunshot, Lazy Bone. But I could have sworn. Yeah, so it must have really happened then.
Yeah, brother, you are absolutely right about that. That happened in 97 in Fraser. And, man, what a terrible time of life. And, again, that had to be... That had to deal with me being a knucklehead and being in the streets and just doing stupid stuff I had no business doing, dumb. You know, that's one of those moments, if I could have changed it, I would, but it did happen, and I just thank God every day, man, that, you know, I'm still living. I'm still here to even be talking to you right now, because, that was a bad situation, and it should have been much worse than it was. I will say that was the moment I did fully get out the streets, and I went full focus on music after that. I didn't mess off in the streets anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. We interviewed Drop One Scott, and he told me somebody attacked him with a baseball bat and fractured his skull in several places, and he knew, you know, that the water in the bay was cold. He's like, if I jump in the water, it'll control the swelling in my brain so I don't, you know, die. And that's what saved his life. How bad was it? Like, were you in the hospital for a long time?
No, not for a long time. I was in the hospital, but no, with me, again, this is just, I feel like the Lord had me and protected me, because dude had the pistol to my forehead. And all together, there was about five guys, and they had surrounded me. I was sitting and I was with one of the original members of Second Family, even before we did Killers from the Black Side, when we were first getting things together. And I was dropping him off. He was going in to take care of some business, something, again, probably had no business doing, and I was out in the car waiting on him. He had a pistol on him. I did not. And when he left, I was sitting in that car. I was a sitting duck in a place I had no business being. And, man, these dudes just came surrounding my car. And I had my windows down. Car wasn't even started, so I knew. I was like, I'm done. I knew they got me. And they pulled me out of the window of the car. Didn't even give me a chance to, like, open the door or nothing. They just pulled me out of the driver's side window. And, man, they kept wanting me to get down on the ground, but I felt so vulnerable, like if I was to lay down on the ground, it was over. And I just couldn't force my body down. And so I was kind of squatting, but I didn't want to leave my feet, because I felt like if I still have my feet under me, I can run if I need to or do something. You know, I wasn't thinking straight. And they got frustrated, and they kept trying to push me to the ground. I wouldn't go. And, man, that's when I just – the pop and the pressure on the front part of my head, right at my hairline. The bullet did not penetrate my skull. I don't know if it was the way he was holding it, but it did fracture my skull, but it didn't go in to my head. And, man, it was just blood everywhere, but there was no bullet in my head. I didn't know that at the time. So I was freaking out. And I just remember just all that blood and, man, those dudes going through my car, and then they all just ran off. And, man, I remember, like, the police coming, the ambulance coming, and then going to Methodist South in Whitehaven. So I went from Fraser all the way to Whitehaven. And I was like, that's when I knew it couldn't have been as serious as, you know, I was thinking it was. But, yeah, I spent, like, that evening and the next day in the hospital, and they cleaned it up and wrapped it up. And they just didn't want me to go to sleep that night because it was a bad head injury. And so they kept me up, wouldn't let me sleep. And I remember that. But blessing, brother, huge blessing, because yeah, that could have gone so differently. Yeah.
Absolutely, man. I mean, you extended 25 years or whatever of life, you know, here to do what you're doing today. Let's go to another song, and then I'm going to bring on the homie Sin, man. I'm glad you made it through that. Yeah, I swore. You must have told me that years ago.
Probably did, yep.
Let's see. We got Step to Drama and Guess Who's Back. Man, you pick which one you want to play now, which one you want to save for the end.
Man, let's go with the Step Up to Drama, because that's actually a DJ Trick beat there. But it's not one of his typical beats. I got that track really when I first started messing with Trick, and when we started working together. But I had went to Albuquerque to do that tape. He was still in Memphis. And, man, I just remember he had had that tape on a cassette. And I heard the tape, and I was like, oh, or I heard the beat. I said, man, we got to do something with that. He's like, man, use it. And it's just a simple drum machine beat, but, man, Trick just has a way of just bumping out. So that's when y'all hear that song, just know that's a DJ Trick beat. I just added the little samples in the chorus.
And if you want to check him out now, he's Pop Off Fresh.
Yes, sir.
One half of West End. So,
man,
you know, that's so
hey, did
you
know
back.
Oh, bro, he actually won Producer of the Year in this country rap space, the stuff we're doing now. Country rap,
of course.
Yeah, they nominated him, and then people voted, and they were voting online, and, man, he won it. So I just want to shout out DJ Trick, Pow Pow Fresh, congrats, bro, Producer of the Year, man. That's an amazing accomplishment.
Well, well deserved, man. That's awesome to hear. Man, we'll be right back. Don't go nowhere. We got King JC, Murder Master Music Show.
The first thing when I got to Albuquerque that everybody asked me was, where the hell the second family at? Well, them motherfuckers is in Memphis hiding like some scared biatches, you know what I'm saying? Because King JC about to take over this shit. It's an everlasting world, motherfuckers. Everlasting drama too thick. Second family eat a dick. We taking over this summer, ha, biatch. Like this.
When I get to the blood, I'm laying the perpetrator down to rest. You bitch motherfuckers, you know when you going when you see the size of my chest. I'm sitting rowdy in the lane of the sand, and I'm doing that shit in our name. 9-7 was good to me, but you haters trying to claim what you all thought was fame. Now looking at JC, y'all jealous and try to label me a sellout. Cause I won't make track for free. Second family, get the dick now. The bitch is a clique, the one with the brain. You know what your name is, fool. If I go to Memphis and see you in the street, you better know now we ain't cool. I made your career and I'll take it away. Don't ever try to test for clean. Cause if you step up, I'm cracking your head and dropping you to the concrete. Talking that smack about King JC, who the fuck do you think you is? You better be smart if you wanna survive, so stay the hell up out my biz.
Step up to
drama, get your head cracked. Step up the drama, get your head cracked. Get your head cracked. Step up the drama, get your head cracked. Step up the drama, get your head cracked. Get your head cracked.
Hey, y'all hating motherfuckers. Y'all know who you is, you know what I'm saying? Lil Rock, ugly motherfucker. Don't hate on me cause I hooked up with a real clique. Y'all gonna be struggling forever, and I made it, motherfuckers. Sucker ass bitches.
A word about that motherfucker. Have a different name every week. You should've kept your name the same, cause who explaining why the hell you sing? And Little Rock,
I know
why you call yourself Little. Cause pinky fingers like nuts, that's your fundamental. And pistol grip, you need to get your grip on a job. Cause everybody knows that you're too weak to steal and rob. But that's the first thing that you bitches speak up in your rap. And now the whole world knows that shit was just a bunch of crap. I'm knocking y'all down and breaking you off. See, none of y'all ever was true. We tried to call ourselves a family, but now all of that shit is through. I'm fading y'all free, who dare to make money? I was the one with the plan. I'm taking y'all rounds and laying them down. Do you bitches understand?
Step up the drama, get your head cracked. Step up the drama, get your head cracked. Get your head cracked. Step up the drama, get your head cracked.
You motherfuckers.
See, I was the one making the cheese. King JC ain't no joke. Nothing but violence till the day I die, leaving you bitches in smoke. See, I'm hailing from the southwest, the desert end of ABQ. And now that I'm gone, y'all bitches are crying, cause all your chances are through. Now all of you tricks are alone, not even knowing how to sack. Cause I was the only one who had your back, but without me y'all are just whack. Now you're seeing me on TV, and try to get down with my clique. But drama already too big,
so second family eat a dick. Step up the drama, get your head cracked. Step up the drama, get your head cracked. Step up the drama, get your head cracked. Step up the drama, get your head cracked.
Or not, music is dope with or without cursing. But the answer you gave me was very dope at the time. You said, because why I learned over time that I could remove the F word or this or that and paint more descriptive words rather than using curse words. You know, anybody could say motherfucker
right,
20
right.
times in a song. Why not replace 10 of those motherfuckers with something else?
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Yeah, it had become a pet peeve of mine when I would just hear rappers do that just to fill space, you know. I felt like you could come stronger lyrically without having to do all that. But, of course, the song you just played, man, it was kind of raw, man. I went off on that one.
Yeah. But, you know, that's part of the evolution process as an artist, you know. Like we talked about this in the West 10 interview, you're not going to sound now like you did in 93, you know. So it was all part of your story, man. Nothing to be ashamed of at all, brother. We're going to close out with Guess Who's Back, and we're not going to let Sin on the show tonight because he doesn't deserve to ask you any questions. I'm just joking. Here's our brother Sin from France. Sin, how you doing, bro?
Yes. Hi, Scott. Hi, King JC, legend.
maybe we really ain't going to have Sin to ask any questions tonight. Sin, are you there?
Man, yeah, it got quiet quick. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we lost him. Sin, if you can hear me, call back in or something. I love Sin because he goes back. Like, he... you know, he's a huge fan of the music, so he's like, best way to describe him is like the French J-Dog. You know, he's
exactly
an encyclopedia. Sin,
right.
Are you there, brother?
Yeah.
Can't hear you. There he is. There he is.
Yeah.
Okay, Sin.
Yeah.
We got you, fam.
Sometimes
you
got... Yeah, can you tell us about this song, The Supernatural, with the DJ Spanish Fly, Memphis Pioneer?
Yes, sir. DJ Spanish Fly was my producer when I was signed to OB Records. He was a friend of Oscar Barnes, CEO of OB Records. And so I met Fly through Oscar. And he was one of the first DJ producers that I met when I touched down in Memphis. And to be able to work with him was a huge blessing. It shouldn't have happened, because if anybody, especially in Memphis, they know that Fly didn't really work with a lot of Memphis artists. It was very rare for him to do that, because he was just more focused on spinning records, and he had his tapes that he put out, but he didn't like doing a lot of features. And so I remember the night we recorded Supernatural, we were all in the studio, and Pretty Tony was there with us. DJ Spanish Fly was there. Bunch of other cats. There were a bunch of us in the studio that night, and we were really just freestyling, and Spanish Fly was on the drum machine and just banging out a beat, and he had something going. It was really nice. And so he was like, yeah, man, let's go ahead and get it. Let's drop a song. And I said, yeah, let's drop a song. Let's do it. And, I can't even remember who came up with the idea for the hook. One of us, either him, me, or it could have been somebody like Pretty Tony or something. And, they just went ahead, got the hook recorded, and Spanish Fly came in and freestyled his entire verse on there. I think he might have punched in once, but it was amazing to see. This man did not write anything ever. He just, everything was always off the dome with Spanish Fly. So, man, it was a great night. I was a very young kid. To be able to rock a song with Spanish Fly is one of the highlight points of my whole rap career, because he's just so legendary and iconic, you know.
Yeah, right. And, also, can you tell us about your first album, The Next Episode, and the song Black Haven, B.H.D., in fact?
Yeah. So Next Episode was my number 7 solo tape. And I recorded most of that in 96. I was recording those songs on my 4-track in my studio while I was still working with Oscar Barnes and OB Records, because when you're on a label, especially when they got a deep roster, there's a lot of attention and focus isn't put on you as the artist. So I was hungry. I was always wanting to write songs, record songs. So I would just be working on songs on my own. And the next episode tape was that tape. I pretty much recorded it simultaneously as I did the Straight From The Bottom, number six. I just didn't put it out until I realized number six wasn't going to come out. And the song Black Haven, which was definitely an iconic song, man. It's one of those songs. And I'm sorry, guys. I don't know. Somebody's trying to blow my phone up. I hope that's not cutting out the words. Can y'all hear me?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
you sound pretty good.
Okay. So Black Haven was a song. It was representing our hood. We were all from Black Haven, BHZ, Black Haven Zone. Again, I lived in Southern Hills, and the artist on that song with me is Pistol Grip from Second Family. He was always the one in the group I was the most close with. He was my right-hand guy, and, man, we were really tight. So we were sitting around and talking about plans for – I think it was we were working on Killers from the Black Side at the time, and he wanted to do a song that represented BHZ. And so I think he was sitting around freestyling, and he had the idea for what ended up becoming the chorus, and it ends up like kind of a sample of his voice is how we did it. But it really came from him as far as the idea to do that song, and then we recorded it, and man, loved it, fell in love with it, and it became the first song on my number seven album. And I think that track there was done with the DR5, the Dr. Rhythm Boss Drum Machine, DR5.
Yeah. Okay, right. Can you tell us about the Memphis Pioneers? I think about D-Magic or the Evan Spanish Fly back the day. When you got all the club scenes, I mean about Clown No Name, Club Expo, you know, Studio G, back the day, I was there in 95, which was crazy shit. Can you tell us about the atmosphere of this era, especially in the 90s, in fact, 95,
yeah.
96?
Right. The atmosphere of the club scene in Memphis in the early 90s was like nothing anybody's seen unless you were there. It was, magical, legendary. I don't even know if I have enough verbs to describe it, man. It was so amazing. First of all, you had these clubs that were not large clubs, small space, and you have hundreds of folks packed off into them, and then you have a DJ like somebody like Spanish Fly. And there were many DJs in Memphis at the time, but Spanish Fly was he was the early legendary DJ that we had in Memphis, and he would rock shows. And then you had artists coming to perform. So when artists came to perform, that's when it really turned up. And I mean, that ended up inspiring 3-6 to make a song called Tear the Club Up. It was the scene that did that. It was the culture of the Memphis club scene that inspired them to even do a song like that, because that's what it was. When Memphis rappers hit the stage, the club got tore up. And then we also had the gangster walking, what you would call juking or buck jumping. Earlier on, it was buck jumping, and then that was Memphis Gangster Walking, which I think the last time we spoke, we kind of touched on that, where you would see the entire crowd gangster walk simultaneously, and it looked like a whirlpool of people just going in
a
circle.
It was a Bovan family at first, right? The Bovan walk before gangster walk back in the day.
Yeah, absolutely,
yeah,
man.
Right.
And it, yeah, but it like just like nothing you ever seen, brother. And I mean, again, you had to be there to really appreciate what I'm saying because my words can't do it justice. But it was something that happened at a period of time in the city of Memphis. And, man, I mean, I think it influenced the whole culture. You could even go to say it influenced folks to this day because it influenced the music, which if you look at the hip-hop industry today and from north to south, east to west, everybody somewhat sound like they're from Memphis or that they've been highly influenced from Memphis
right.
rap, even in their production.
That's true.
Yeah. But there was a time and place where it wasn't like that anywhere but here. Memphis was the originator of all that. And so, I feel blessed that I got to see that before it went away forever. Not that it has, like, fully gone away, but, I mean, today it's just nothing like what it was back then. It's nowhere near it. It's a different world, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right.
So many levels.
Yeah.
There were great producers back in the day in Memphis, like Blackout, like DJ Sound, like Psycho, Lil Grimm.
Yes.
Psycho Evan maybe was the first to record a Devil Shit, maybe. Evan before Paul. With OTS
and
he was in one Man in the Hour, Man of the Hour of Al Capone, OTS.
Right. Yeah. I agree. Yeah, Psycho was really up on that stuff early on. So, I don't think he really gets the credit he deserves for really influencing the Memphis sound in that way. But he did.
Yeah.
That's what's up.
You did a lot. You reviewed also reviewing Murder Dog back in the day with Scott.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, but not quite on his level. I mean, he was the king of that stuff, man. That was his lane.
Thank you, brother.
I was blessed to be able to, you know, do a few reviews and to I think I wrote a article on Albuquerque as far as all the artists out there. Oh, New Mexico, I think. I did something on New Mexico, but yeah, man, Scott Prez was the man on that stuff.
I'll tell you what, when I got there, when I was shocked to see you and Al Capone there, I was like, this has got to be a dream, man, because, you know, I was already listening to you guys at that time, you know, so I was like, wow, this is dope.
Yeah.
We were fortunate, though, to be able to do that at that time, because we were able to turn people on to a lot of dope music, you know.
That's right. That's true. Definitely.
Can't forget J-Dog. He was with us, too.
Yes, he was.
J-Dog.
Yes, he was.
You know, we got to have him on the show sometime, Sin, and chop it up with him. I'd really like to hear that conversation between you two, because I know you both are like hip-hop encyclopedias, you know. So that would be something. But, JC, brother, I really, really want to thank you for taking time to talk to us tonight. Had a really good conversation. Before we go, I want to give you the floor. We're going to leave, to Guess Who's Back. But I want to give you the floor, man. You, whatever you want, it's all yours, brother.
Okay, I appreciate that, brother. I know right now I just started an Instagram account under King JC the Boogeyman. So that's brand new. Just a few days ago, got that up. I'm going to be spending a lot of time on Instagram just trying to reconnect with all the fans of Memphis rap and underground tape collectors. I've already been meeting a ton of people just in a few days, having great conversations with them. I've been DMing them. They've been hitting me back, and we're having great conversations. So, been appreciative of that. So if anybody wants to get at me, just, man, go to Instagram. It's King JC the Boogeyman, and I'll be there because I'm really trying to get everybody together before we drop this collection, because I want to make sure all the true fans, the true collectors, get a hold of it. And then outside of that, I would just say, please, if you have not checked out West 10, that's WEST10, the number 10. It's for West Tennessee, but it, West 10 is our group, and that's me and DJ Trick, a.k.a. Paw Paw Fresh, and we got a brand new album out called Put Some Country in It. It's different, but it's not so different. I think y'all will dig it, so please check it out. Go to YouTube. We got our shows, our concerts that we've done on YouTube, our official music videos, songs, everything, interviews are all on there. So please, y'all go check that out. And I appreciate you.
Man, that's what I'm talking about. And you're right, man. The music, when you guys hear it, I mean, you guys are flipping. You're killing it, man, production-wise. You know, everybody get that West 10 support. Be on the lookout for this King JC Playlistic Entertainment discography that's coming soon. And we look forward to that.
Yes,
now, this
sir.
Is Guess Who's Back. One more thing from you, Jay. Tell us about this song as we get out of here.
All right. So Guess Who's Back was on my number 9 album, which Step Up to Drama was as well. That was called A New Beginning because at the time I left Memphis to come back to Albuquerque, I was leaving the second family to work with Everlasting Drama. That's why I called it A New Beginning. And Guess Who's Back is just a song saying, yeah, y'all thought I was gone. Nope, I'm back at it. And, yeah, that was a fun album. Recording that entire album was fun. The Guess Who's Back, I produced it, and it was with a 660 drum machine. That's about all I used on that track. And it was recorded on a Tascam 464 four-track. Probably in whatever bedroom and whatever apartment I was living in Albuquerque at the time. So, yeah, man, I hope y'all enjoy it. It's some old stuff, but, man, it was back in the day when I was super hungry. So, yeah, I hope y'all enjoy it.
Man, that's what's up, man. Peace out to King JC. Man, we're out of here.
Stupid motherfucker. Don't you have your chance. All them haters in the desert land. I'm messed up out my city.
Yeah.